From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in South Carolina in 2004. A Republican named Bob Inglis was elected to Congress for the second time, and that year his oldest child was voting for the first time. Bob Inglis's son told him that he would vote for his dad, but he expected his dad to get serious about climate science. As a conservative Republican, Inglis had bought the party line on climate change. It was just a figment of Al Gore's imagination, of course. But Inglis admitted to himself that he'd never actually studied it. And now that his kids were urging him to look into it, he agreed. So he went to Antarctica. He talked to scientists. And he quickly became convinced that climate change was not only real, but it was his duty as a Christian to help do something about it. So Congressman Inglis began advocating for the kinds of policy that could mitigate climate change. He told his colleagues and voters, fear not, his ideas were market-based, conservative, pro-business, relying on innovation. Good for the planet, yes, but good for business too. The Republican Party did not appreciate his evolution on climate. The next election, Inglis lost in a primary. His position on climate science was almost certainly a big part of his defeat. But you see, leaving Congress did not mean the end of Bob Inglis' work on climate science. Today, he's still a conservative Republican, and he's working to get those same policies passed, the ones that probably cost him his career in Congress. I've asked him to be my guest to talk about how to reach skeptics, people who don't accept the science, because Bob Inglis used to be one of them, and he is kind enough to join us. Bob, it's my honor to have you. How are you, sir?
Good, Evan. Great to be with you.
Well, let me just start with just asking you if you remember the first time you ever even thought about climate science, whether it was in your first run in Congress, your second time around. When did you first start thinking about climate science?
Well, of course, in my first 6 years in Congress, as you just said, I said it was nonsense. I really didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. But and I represented the reddest district and the reddest state in the nation. So that was the end of the inquiry as far as I was concerned. But along the way, 6 years out of Congress, doing commercial real estate law again, and then running again in 2004 is when my son said, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. That started things. And as you said, this science committee trip to Antarctica, followed by another science committee trip, and being inspired by an Aussie climate scientist who I could tell shared a worldview even before any words were spoken. And I got inspired by his example, really, of trying to love God and love people by caring for people to come after us.
Now, if anybody listening is a conservative listener, I'd love to hear from them this hour. If you don't believe the science on climate, and this is the kind of person I think can speak directly to some of your concerns or what you've heard or why you don't necessarily believe the science. But if you're also the kind of person who wants to know how to communicate more effectively with people who may be of a different political persuasion, but you want to reach out, you want to bridge that gap, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And Bob, did you, in those years, were you sort of, there's this idea in the media that the Republican Party has been given marching orders, that we're disputing publicly climate science, that Al Gore is not someone we're going to be on the same side with on this issue, and that, you simply deny it. Was there any sort of structure behind the scenes to kind of deny it no matter what came out of the science?
Not that I encountered. I mean, there are, of course, powerful groups and lots of money that speak against climate action. But it's not like it was any kind of orchestrated effort at the Republican leadership level, for example. It was just mostly it's a matter of the dominant tune playing on talk radio is that, for conservatives, is that climate change is hooey and we don't need to pay any attention to it. And it's overcoming that narrative that's the big challenge.
Do you want to go ahead and counter any concerns that our conservative listeners have that you're just a rhino, that you're not actually a conservative Republican, that you're just the left is using you as a prop? You are very much a conservative Republican, right?
Yeah, it's like this 93 American Conservative Union rating. That's an A in most places. 100% Christian Coalition, 100% National Right to Life, A with the NRA, zero with the Americans for Democratic Action. That's a liberal group, and 23 by some mistake with the AFL-CIO, a labor union. I was hoping for a zero, actually. A pretty conservative guy who represented the reddest district and reddest state of the nation, Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina. It's actually that conservatism that drives me now at republicen.org, because we believe that what we're talking about is consistent with the deeply held beliefs of conservatives. We conservatives believe that people should be accountable, and that accountability brings blessings. It's the lack of accountability that creates all kinds of havoc in our families, in communities, in the whole world. It's the lack of accountability that creates trouble. So if you hold people accountable, you say, listen, you got to be even biblically accountable for what you do on your property. You can't do on your property something that harms somebody else's property or person or life. Be responsible. That's what we conservatives believe, and that's really all we're advocating when it comes to climate change, because we believe that what we have here, republicen.org, we believe what we have here is a problem of economics that has an environmental consequence. And the economics problem is that we don't have accountability for emissions. We don't impose that accountability on ourselves and on others. And as a result, we have a very unaccountable system that creates all kinds of troubles. If we were just accountable for all that we do by way of emissions, innovation could happen. The reason that innovation can't happen yet is that we don't have accountability yet. If we had accountability, then all kinds of new fuels would be brought to the marketplace. People would be offering us new products, but they got to wait until those are economic. So, as I say, we think we got a problem here of economics that has an environmental consequence. You fix the economics, you fix the environmental problem.
Talking to Bob Inglis, who is my guest for part of the hour. We're going to keep him as long as we can to get some of your questions in. So, Bob in Rochester, hang on line one for 1 second here. But listeners, I want to let you know even a little bit more about Bob Inglis, whose story I find remarkable. First of all, you should right now go check out, or at least when the show's over, check out his TEDx talk, which I think lays out the story beautifully and is, I think it's tailor-made if you've got conservative friends who have doubts about science to at least understand a little bit better of the mindset. You should also know that he was the JFK Library's Profile and Courage Award winner for 2015, and the JFK Library has been bestowing this award, the Profile and Courage Award, to public servants who take principled but unpopular positions since 1989. Some of the biggest names in politics and in the world have won this award, and he was the 2015 winner. I'd like to listen to, if we could, a little bit from that ceremony. This is Jack Schlossberg, who's the grandson of JFK, introducing Bob Inglis and saying that Bob Inglis is the kind of person who is exactly who a Profile in Courage is made for.
He went back to Washington and broke with his party when he publicly stated that climate change is real and America needs to do something about it. He proposed aggressive reforms, even though he knew that he would enrage his colleagues, his base, and special interests. But he summoned the courage to push ahead. For Bob, the truth certainly was inconvenient. In response for his stance on climate change, his party recruited a Tea Party candidate to challenge him in 2010 and drove him out of office. But this defeat didn't discourage Bob.
That is from that ceremony. And Bob, did you know when you came out with policy ideas, even though you were telling your own party, even though you were telling your district, these are right-leaning, these are conservative principles, this is pro-business, this is relying on American innovation. Did you know that this could cost you your job?
Yes. I mean, it was, I maybe was foolish enough to believe that I could make a difference. But you know, we need those kind of fools, don't we?
Yeah, I would say
people that are just foolish enough to think that we can make a difference. And so that's my guiding principle there. And of course, you know, for me, courage is such an important value in politics and public life. And I feel so sorry for people that might end a long congressional career, let's say, and they get to the very end and they're retiring and they're wheeling their stuff out, you know, to put in their car and go home. And maybe they look in the mirror and they see somebody that just went along to get along and really never stood for anything. I can't imagine what that moment must be like and how terrible that would be. So much better to fall even in a blaze of glory, you know, rather than to go out in that very sad state of never having made a difference or never attempted to make a difference.
Before I grab some phone calls here, Bob, let our listeners know again, it's republicen.org. What will they find there, and what would you ask our listeners to kind of check out?
They'll find ways that free enterprise can address climate change, and they can stand with us and call on fellow conservatives to present these free enterprise solutions. So it's really important that people stand with us, because right now, elected officials assume that we must be albino unicorns. We just don't exist. Conservatives that say climate change is real and there are free enterprise solutions to it, we got to show them in pictures, actually, the pictures of the people that we're out here. And so in under 2 minutes, they can stand with us on the website and snap a selfie and upload a reason that they're there with us. And the result will be that that elected officials in their own district and others can see that there are conservatives who want their party to be relevant on this issue.
My guest is former Congressman Bob Inglis from republicen.org. He lost his job when he was primaried and lost in 2010 after coming out as a conservative Republican concerned about climate change and proposing market-based solutions. And so we're talking about his experience there and how to conduct outreach to people who might disagree. And I've got a caller on the line who calls a lot when we talk about climate change. He's a very nice guy. His name's John. He's a conservative, and he doesn't buy it. And I'm going to bring him in now, and you guys can have a little chat about this. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Bob. You know,
hello.
Congratulations on the JFK Award. JFK was a fine American and a conservative Democrat. But I got to say, the Kennedy family right now, especially Robert Kennedy Jr., is an environmental extremist. So I'm not that impressed that you were awarded this that honor, because I don't trust the Kennedy clan. I think they're just Robert Kennedy himself is an extremist on the environment, and I'm not only talking about man-made climate change. But just to throw this out, Bob, where we sit right now here in Rochester, New York, 15,000 years ago, 14,000 years ago, there was a mile and a half high glacier above us. That glacier left us. I think my argument is based upon, I think a lot of climate, and I'm not denying there's climate change, I question the extent, if any, man has in its happening. The sun, I think, is a major factor in climate change. And I'll give you an example. They've done studies on the surface temperature on Mars has been increasing since we've been monitoring that. And I just read recently Jupiter has had temperature increases on the surface of Jupiter. And a lot of the issues from that happening are caused by the sun. Also, methane, naturally emitted methane from volcanoes and other areas. I guess in Pennsylvania, there are millions of acres of land that over a long period of time emit methane. So this is an issue I think that has been perpetrated in part by some of the Marxists in extreme left-wing groups that originally came out of out of Russia and Eastern Europe, and are degrowthers and want to see capitalism taken off the earth and defanged, and they want to push a Marxist degrowth type movement. And I think what's happened is the media has caught on to this. I'll give you an example. Naomi Klein, who was a fanatic Marxist, right now I think is a consultant to the Pope on climate change, and she made a comment one time that said that this climate, man-made climate change issue is really great because now they can push, it's another weapon that the degrowthers can use to stop productivity and stop capitalism.
All right, so John, let's let Bob respond. And Bob, let me start by asking you this. Was there a time in your career where you would have said, John's on the money?
Yeah. In English 1.0, as we called it, I would have said, yeah, John, you're right. I wouldn't have known much about it. I would have said, yeah, sounds fine to me. Move on to the next question. In English 2.0, I actually went and found out some data. So the data I'd pass on to you, John, is suggest to you that you go to a site called Skeptical Science. Skeptical Science. If you just Google Skeptical Science, you'll get to this site.
Okay.
And it's the it's a very common statement that it's the sun. But if you look there, it's issue number 2. They identify 10 of the most commonly articulated myths about climate. The first is that climate's changed before, and then the second is it's the sun. It's a very common assertion. It's just, unfortunately, it's just not correct. Is that the sun is actually in a cooling period, and so we're in a warming period. And if it just doesn't correlate, it's just inaccurate.
Well, how do you explain Mars and Jupiter? Surface temperatures on Mars and Jupiter are increasing without any as far as I know, there are no men on Mars and Jupiter right now.
Right. I don't know. That's beyond my capacity. I don't know about Mars and Jupiter, but I do know this, that think about the way this works. And this is what got to me is when I saw the evidence in Antarctica, it's what you find in the ice core drillings in Antarctica is a fabulous record of the Earth's atmosphere and the levels of CO2 for many, many years back. And what you see in that record is an uptick in the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere that coincides with the Industrial Revolution. And I'm not a scientist, I'm a commercial real estate lawyer, but doesn't that make sense that, you know, if I'm burning a tree in my fireplace this winter, which I hope to do, and let's say that tree was just growing on my farmette, that tree was taking CO2 out of the air as part of its life process. And when I burn it in my fireplace, I'm just releasing, I'm causing those gases to react and to ignite and to turn into CO2 as it goes up my chimney. It's all in the same geological time period, no big deal. But if I go deep into the earth and pull up trees that have been gone for a long, long time, and I burn them, I change the chemistry of the air. And nobody disputes that, by the way. And then nobody disputes this either, that the physics of light are such that light enters, but all the heat from that light doesn't escape from the earth. Thank goodness. If it did, we'd freeze to death at night and burn up during the day. So we've got this wonderful layer of greenhouse gases around us that keeps us at a really amazingly blessed state here on this one planet that we know we can live on. And so nobody disputes that. The only dispute is the level of nobody disputes this chemistry of the air comment. Nobody disputes the physics of light there. It's just the question about whether could it be statistically significant. And this science seems to indicate that it is statistically significant, that we are having an impact. And a lot of people think, well, it's so small. I mean, how we are so small, the world's so big. But if you think about it, it's a teeny, teeny virus that enters your body, and you can be quite sick. These small things can actually be quite powerful. And so, but you're right, John, about methane is an issue. There's a lot of natural methane. I grew up at the coast of South Carolina, and I can tell you that marsh gas is methane. It smells funny, it's a greenhouse gas. It's naturally occurring, but when you, again, go deep in the earth and pull up methane and let it escape, that's a really bad day when it escapes, because it's a very powerful greenhouse gas. But to the very interesting thing that you mentioned, John, about the Marxist and Naomi Klein, I once, I'm not sure how far Mohonk is from where you are, but I debated Naomi Klein this time last year, and I found it very interesting that Naomi is making a very fine living in the capitalist system, attacking the capitalist system. It was very clear to me that she makes a lot more money than I do, she's doing quite well at attacking capitalism in the capitalistic system. So I found that, I agree with you, that seems a little bit odd. I have a movie to recommend to you, Merchants of Doubt. It's a film about exactly what you're just saying, that there are some people who believe that it's a Marxist kind of ideology that's driving this. And I think if you watch Merchants of Doubt, you'll be challenged in that assumption.
When it comes to the idea of a liberal media conspiracy, you know, I talked to a popular skeptical writer named Guy Harrison a couple of years ago, and he said, look, of course climate science is valid, it's real. But Bob, he thinks Al Gore actually did a little bit of damage to the movement by inserting himself so prominently because he is such a political figure. In other words, if it wasn't Al Gore, but somebody else who was less of a lightning rod, that maybe we wouldn't be sitting here today so deeply divided on on the politics, or at least the policy side. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, maybe so. I surely don't think it was Al Gore's intent to have that effect. One of the things I learned that seems to be, there's some sort of a mantra when I was in Congress, it's been thrown out now, is don't try to attribute motives to anybody, because you really don't know what's in anybody else's head and in their heart. So don't try to attribute motives. But, you know, so a lot of people attribute motives to Al Gore that I don't know whether they're accurate or not. I mean, why not take it on face value that Al Gore wants to do something about climate? Well, good. And so does Art Laffer, who's Ronald Reagan's economic advisor. He's a neighbor of Al Gore's. He's been over to Al's house. I know this from Art telling me and Al confirming it. They talked it through. They came to the conclusion that for both of them, the solution is what we talk about at republicen.org, and that is the accountability for emissions, that'd be a carbon tax, coupled with a corresponding tax cut, so there's no growth in government, or a dividend check, which is what my friends at Citizens Climate Lobby want to do. Either way, you end up with no growth of government and accountability imposed for emissions. And so Art Laffer and Al Gore can agree. And I got inspired by that. I thought, Evan, this is fabulous. If we can bring Art Laffer and Al Gore together, we can bring America together, and America can lead the world to a solution. It's a small government, light touch solution, fixes in the economics, and then have the environment take care of itself.
Now, we'll try to let you go in just a couple of minutes here, Bob. A couple other quick questions here. Since you sort of came out on the side of climate science, proposed that policy in Congress. You lose a primary. Your party essentially turned against you. I'm curious, have any Republican colleagues at least talked to you privately and said, I get it. I can't do this publicly. I can't get there publicly. Or at least have they asked questions? Has that happened?
Yeah, all of the above. And, you know, I had a great meeting just 2 weeks ago with a Republican senator who I know understands these things and is looking for a way to make it work. So I'm encouraged. There are Republicans who know that this is a problem and who believe there's a solution. The question is, can we get through the assumed problems that are out there? I mean, John is raising the questions that are often asked. If we can answer those well, there's a solution available. If we can't answer those questions, then we really are just stuck with no action.
Sure, and I think the more you talk to conservatives and remind them that this can be a market-based, a pro-business approach, relying on American innovation without growing the size of government, then maybe there is a way to break through. So listeners, if you want to have those productive conversations, republicen.org to learn more about exactly what Bob is talking about here. Bob, I have a slew of people emailing me, begging me to ask you if you're frustrated by the tone of the presidential race, and if you're even considering voting for a Democrat in this race, just because you do have one of the most anti-climate science candidates I can remember in Donald Trump, who did tweet that he thought it was a hoax invented by the Chinese, even though at the debate he said otherwise. So I'll ask on the behalf of the listeners, how do you feel about that?
I'm terribly disappointed with the presidential race. I think that it is just a sad state of affairs that we have come to. I've placed myself early in the never Trump category. I think that I'm very concerned about not just the climate positions of Donald Trump, but the whole his demeanor. I just find it. I just can't believe that we are actually talking about a reality TV host becoming president of the United States. And some people would say, "Well, Ronald Reagan, your hero, and he is one of my heroes, was a B-grade movie actor." A lot of people like to say, "Well, he was a movie actor, and then he was a two-time governor of California, one of the largest states. 1/7 of the American economy is in California. And he did a fine job there, in my estimation, and apparently in the estimation of a lot of people. And so he had quite a bit of preparation for the job of being president, having been the governor of 1/7 of the American economy. I think it's a completely different situation we've got going now, where we really need to take stock about how do we end up here? How do we end up in this spot? And I think part of it is us going along rather than having the courage to say to people like John, check out Skeptical Science. Look there and see what it says about sunspots. Look at the data. Let's not just repeat to each other the misinformation that we think we know. Let's be big enough to go look at the data, and the data shows that it's not the sun. The data shows that it is the burning of fossil fuels. And so then let's deal with it, and then let's be big enough to say, you know what? Either I was wrong, that's what I said, but maybe we don't need everybody to do that, because for some people, they don't have the love of their son and his four sisters and his mother and his dear friend, the Aussie climate scientist that I mentioned earlier, supporting him in that 180-degree swap or switch around. Maybe what we can do is just ask people to make a 90-degree swap. or switch, which is to say the solution that's been offered so far has been a big government solution. It's cap and trade. That was a disaster, in my opinion. I voted against it. I sound like Donald Trump calling it a disaster, don't I? But anyway, I voted against it because I thought it was hopelessly complicated, embarrassing the free allocations for the well-connected, would have decimated American manufacturing, and it was a massive tax increase. So for all those reasons, I voted against cap and trade. But I propose the alternative, which is this revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax. And so what we need is people to have the courage to say, you know what, well, let's stop just dealing with the myths that we tell each other. Let's look at the data, and then let's find a solution that fits with our values. I think one's available. And as I said earlier, Evan, the good news is that Al Gore and Art Laffer can agree on that solution. That's pretty exciting.
It's republicen.org. Bob, can I squeeze in just one more listener who's been waiting to talk to you?
Sure, you're up, Ethan.
Bob in Rochester, on with Bob Inglis. Go ahead, Bob.
Great, thanks so much. Just a couple quick things based on what the last caller said. I think when we say about natural cycles, we fall into the trap of either or. The point is both can and do occur at the same time. The question is the rate of acceleration. Yes, you don't deny that there's natural cycles, but what is the rate of change? And it's all the data. Looking at the data and why we need to look at the data is why it doesn't matter if we say Marxists are for it, Angela Davis is for it, David Duke is for it. Who cares if they're for or against gravity? The saying who's for something is irrelevant at this point. It's what does the data show? So, and I just want to say I've always thought rather than frame this politically, this should always be seen as a public safety / engineering question. We're building a building in an earthquake zone or whatever. What do we need to do to reinforce it? Should that be political? Not really, not at all. It's really too bad it's become political. And I think, again, framing it that way is a disservice. It's like when we're building a bridge, we don't frame it politically, really, other than how do we, you know, whether we should do it. But in terms of the science and the data, it's not a political issue. My question for Bob is simply, do you believe that most of your colleagues that do not want to support solutions to climate science, it seems like there's like five possible reasons. They either don't believe the facts, they're relying on bad information sources, they're afraid of the implications, that is, more regulation, or it challenges their worldview too much, or potentially it's giving the other side ammunition. Which of those do you think is the most common reason or something else why some of your colleagues are still denying climate reality?
Bob, thank you. Go ahead, Bob Inglis.
Yeah, I think what it is, the main reason is what's called solution aversion. It's the assumed solution is anathema. And so because we have aversion toward that solution, we doubt the existence of the problem. And of course, some people might think, well, that's sort of irrational, isn't it? How can you say, well, we don't like the solution, so do we doubt the existence of the problem? Well, it'd be like me saying to Evan, here's the plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. I don't know if Evan has a back problem or not, but here's a plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. First, we're going to remove your head. We get your head off, then we work on your spine. We put your head back on. Evan's going to say to me, thanks, doc. I'm feeling a lot better. I don't have a back problem because the solution's anathema. And so what happened here is climate change. The climate change conversation started by what we assume to be godless scientists. They're not all godless scientists, but anyway, they're assumed to be godless scientists. Got together with the bureaucrats at the UN, and then they pulled in the Wall Street traders and came up with a cap and trade scheme. And the problem is, there's nothing in that paragraph that conservatives like. They don't like the godless scientists. They don't like the government, the UN bureaucrats. They don't like the Wall Street traders. And so if the conversation rather had, let's say, been started by the U.S. military and somebody telling us, listen, this is a real serious national security threat we've got going here, and we need to do something about it. By the way, the military is saying that, but that's not where the conversation started. as the conversation goes on, perhaps those voices will be heard, and they need to be heard. But it's all about assuming that the solution is anathema that causes us to doubt the existence of the problem. And so what we have to do is show that there's a solution that works, that fits with our values. And, of course, at republicen.org, we're trying to show that as a tax swap, where you put a tax on carbon dioxide and you untax some form of income, or you dividend the money back to the taxpayers. And then you apply it to imports so that it becomes in our trading partners' interest to do the same thing back in their home countries, because they don't want to pay taxes here. They'd rather collect taxes at home. And the result would be that the whole world would then go to a truer costing of energy, and then we'd get the innovation we were talking about earlier. That's what holds back the innovation at this point.
I've got an email from a listener named Karen who says, "Evan, this liberal is literally standing up and cheering at the radio. Please thank Bob Inglis for me for having the courage of his convictions." So that's from Karen, a liberal who may otherwise differ with you on a lot of other issues, Bob, but I assume you've heard some of that. So last question before I let you go. I suspect you can't mention the name of the senator you had that recent conversation with. You can tell us what his name rhymes with if you want, or her names. That's fine. Do you expect some news on that soon? I mean, do you think some of your colleagues are close to being able to come out and say, "Okay, I've come around on the science. I don't care if Al Gore is or whoever it is, I will accept the science." Do you think more of that's coming?
Well, first of all, thank you, Karen, for cheering. That's wonderful. please go help us find your relative that is a conservative who, and get them to go to republicen.org and look around there and see if they can agree with us. There's a free enterprise solution to climate change. And as to when it will happen, Evan, when members of Congress will be comfortable leading on this, it's all up to us, the people. Because politicians typically follow, they don't lead. And so they're waiting to sense support. And if they sense support, they will lead. But right now, they're not sensing that support. And so it's up to us. Because, you know, we all say that Congress doesn't listen to us, they don't pay attention to us. Actually, they listen very intently. And what they're listening for is that we want a solution to this. And once they hear that, they will they'll engage, because they actually do listen very carefully. It's all about us as citizens more than the politicians. It's about us having the responsibility of full citizenship and being able to say, yeah, we understand that there's what economists call unrecognized negative externalities. In other words, things associated with our burning of fossil fuels that we're not accountable for. And we're ready to face those and be full citizens and fully responsible. And if we do that, all kinds of good things are going to happen. Because I said at the outset, blessings flow from accountability. Havoc flows when you don't hold people accountable.
Bob Inglis, former congressman, still very much a conservative Republican, advocating a free market solution as we deal with climate change, republicen.org. Thank you for your time, Bob. Very generous with it, and I hope we can talk again in the future.
Great to talk with you, Evan. Thanks so much.
That's Bob Inglis. We're going to get a short break. We continue on the same subject, and we'll get more of your feedback that we've been hearing throughout this remarkable conversation right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. First hour, we sit down with David Moore, the new chief of the Office of Integrity for Monroe County. As the director, he'll have to remain independent from the people who hired him. Is he prepared to do that? We'll talk to him about his role in county ethics. Then second hour, students and leaders from World of Inquiry School talk about the Colin Kaepernick-style protests and their views on justice. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to bring in Susan Spencer, who is the president of Rockspot, who has been listening to some of the conversation, and we've had a chance to talk to Susan over the last couple of years on a variety of issues related to climate, energy, solar, et cetera. And so, Susan, thank you for taking the time to join the program. How are you?
I'm well, Evan. Thanks for having me on.
Remind our listeners what Rockspot is.
Rockspot is a Rochester company focused on solar advocacy for consumers. So we help folks figure out if it makes sense for them to switch to solar.
You heard it from Bob Inglis, a former Republican congressman who lost his job in Congress because he was somebody who, as he describes it for years, said, well, if Al Gore believes climate change is real, then I don't. And then his kids prevailed upon him to really look at the facts. He took the time to take a trip to Antarctica twice, talked to scientists abroad and at home, and decided that who cares who says what about it, that the facts are the facts, the science is the science. And he lost his job in Congress for it. And first of all, I'm just curious to know what you made of the conversation that you heard with Bob Inglis, Susan.
Well, I think it's wonderful when folks like Bob take the time to really understand the depth and severity of the climate crisis and start to work on brainstorming solutions for how we can mitigate and adapt as a species. There's no argument about the climate crisis being real and humans causing it. I think what we have to figure out now is what's the best path forward for us to keep going.
And Susan, one of the things that he repeatedly says is that if we don't get conservatives on board, it's going to be hard to pass any meaningful policies that get really serious about this. He talked about how for years he and his colleagues in the Republican Party basically just ignored all of the science and evidence. They didn't even listen because it was viewed as a political issue. And only when he really studied the science did he understand it was not a political issue, that he wishes it hasn't become a political issue, but it has. And he says we've got to reach conservatives in some way. Now, his solution is to create a market-based approach to this, to say we don't have to grow government. We can innovate. We can put a carbon tax out there, yes, but we can also create a dividend, sort of a carbon fee and dividend that the Citizens Climate Coalition has been advocating for. But he says it can be a small government approach, that it doesn't have to be something that's anathema to conservative principles. Does that make sense to you? You're somebody who, you've done public forums, you've talked to people of all political stripes. Bob is saying if we don't reach conservatives, we're not going to get policy done. Do you think he's right?
Yes, I agree. I think that this has to be a across-the-aisle solution that both parties don't just agree on, but believe in and champion as something that's incredibly important. And Bob really kind of hits the nail on the head. When we look at the economics of climate change mitigation and adaptation, we are poised to completely, you know, change the way that we look at things like energy efficiency, carbon pollution. And by looking at it from both an environmental and an economic perspective, that's how we'll be able to bring everybody to the table to figure out how we're going to solve this.
I want to listen to, if we could, just a clip from an event I think 90 million Americans watched. Bob Inglis said that he was frankly embarrassed by this presidential campaign, and especially the fact that his party, the Republican Party, has nominated who, in Inglis, in his own words, a reality television host, to be considered for president of the United States. And he said it has been a disaster for the party. Let's listen to that part of the debate in which they talked about where they stand on climate and what to do about it. And we'll get Susan Spencer's reaction to that.
Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think it's real.
I do not say that.
And I think it's important that we grip this and deal with it, both at home and abroad. And here's what we can do. We can deploy a half a billion more solar panels. We can have enough clean energy to power every home. We can build a new modern electric grid. that's a lot of jobs. That's a lot of new economic activity. So I've tried to be very specific about what we can and should do, and I am determined that we're going to get the economy really moving again, building on the progress we've made over the last 8 years, but never going back to what got us in trouble in the first place.
Mr. Trump.
She talks about solar panels. We invested in a solar company, our country. That was a disaster. They lost plenty of money on that one. Now, look, I'm a great believer in all forms of energy, but we're putting a lot of people out of work. Our energy policies are a disaster.
All right, so first of all, I think it's been well documented, but I'll just say again, yes, indeed, Donald Trump has been saying that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. And I don't know why he tried to lie his way out of that at the debate, but he's very much on record in that position. Then, Susan, as for the rest of that, what do you make of what you heard?
Well, I think Mr. Trump is in a position to know a lot about failed investments. I typically try to avoid coming down on either side of the political spectrum.
I know. I'm making you squirm a little bit here, but this one's probably a little easier for you.
Yeah, you know, in this particular case, I think that substantive policies are what are being proposed by Secretary Clinton. I think that, you know, there's ways to go to have them be as effective as they need to be, but it's absolutely deleterious to the American economy and the American people to suggest that this is somehow a hoax and that it's something that we shouldn't be paying attention to. And for someone who's running for, you know, the highest office in our land to do so is frankly dangerous.
Susan, Bob Inglis said that he has heard privately from a good number of other Republicans, former colleagues of his in Congress. He said that he, just a couple of weeks ago, had a conversation with a prominent Republican senator who indicated privately the senator gets the science now, but doesn't necessarily feel quite ready yet to come out publicly and say so because there's a big political risk there. And, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But for you, you talk to political leaders, again, as you said, of all parties, that you try not to be a political person, especially in your work in this role here, that you want to be focused on the evidence and focused on good solutions. But have you seen a divide in the parties, or are you hearing from leaders in both parties who want to talk about rock spot, want to talk about solar, want to talk about your ideas? You know, do you tend to see it politically or not?
In our region, I think that we're pretty lucky with the leadership that we have, both, you know, Republican and Democratic. They've all been more than willing to come to the table and talk about solar energy, talk about green jobs, talk about, you know, energy efficiency improvements and how to do these things in a way that, you know, grows our local businesses, our local solar installers, you know, make sure that low to moderate income individuals aren't left out of this process. We've really seen a broad coalition forming amongst our local political leadership for support of more solar deployment and more access to energy efficiency programs and job training programs that can help people transition into the green economy and start working in their neighborhoods. We've really seen it across the board here.
Let me get Rich in Rochester who wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good.
My question was, there was some things to be happy about that Bob was saying, but my concern is this. He wants to put it all on the economic side in this sense that it's all about the companies. But there's going to have to be regulations on the side about the consumers, the homeowners, and all different other aspects of life that you almost can't not grow government to get control of everything that you need to get control of. We're talking from the farmers and how they farm. There's so many different avenues that have to be approached and dealt with that him talking about carbon tax for companies, I think in the end is going to be a small part of this issue.
Well, Rich, I take the point that you're concerned that the problem is bigger than that. And Susan Spencer, you're someone, you looked at Paris. You've heard what a lot of scientists have said about whether even Paris was enough or if we have to go much, much further. Are you concerned that the policy proposals on the table are not nearly enough? Or do you think in many ways that there are market-based solutions, that there's a way to kind of keep moving forward and mitigating climate change effectively without really growing the size of government?
Well, I'm no expert on government, but I can tell you that a report just came out, I believe today or yesterday, from the Department of Energy demonstrating the cost reductions in clean energy technologies since 2008. LED bulbs have dropped by 94%. Battery costs have gone down by 73%. Utility-scale photovoltaics have gone down by 64%. And distributed photovoltaics have gone down by 54%. So what we see is that the market is helping to drive a clean energy transition. I think the caller brings up a great point, though, that in order for us to solve the climate crisis, we need to be addressing it from such a wide swath of our economy, our lifestyle, just the way that we do everything. And I wouldn't rule out the need for, you know, more or different kinds of regulations in place. That being said, one of the things that we see at Rockspot, at my company, is that when folks switch over to solar, they become more knowledgeable about their energy use and their energy consumption, and they start to make changes on their own because they are now, you know, under control of their own energy costs, and the less they use, the more they save. So some of these can be made by individual folks as well.
Susan, again, the website for people to learn more about what you're doing.
We are at rockspot.org.
R-O-C, rockspot.org. Our thanks to Susan Spencer. Thank you for taking the time, Susan.
Happy to call in, Evan. Thank you.
Susan Spencer from Rockspot. Bob Inglis, former congressman with republicen.org, for more on what he is proposing, market-based solutions that he says should appeal to conservatives like him. Fascinating stuff. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.